Welcome, everybody, to my Starfinder developer diary for the Fly Free or Die. This is a special bonus episode coming to you in between volumes 4 and 5. The physical copies of Fly Free or Die are stuck in a shipping container somewhere and have not been sent out to subscribers yet. So to help fulfill the meantime, I went looking for some new content. And one of the joys of this job is hearing people play our adventures over live play and streaming shows. And I have very lucky to have the gang from Southern Tomfoolery on. Adam and Zach, welcome to the show.
Hello. Hey, thanks for having us.
Glad to be here. First off, I have to note, like, okay, financial disclosure statement. I am a patron of the Southern
and thank you, sir.
Everybody listening to this should be too. But we're gonna spend about an hour here, just kind of talking about your guys' show and how you came to be, your story, and the shows that you're already doing. And we will get to Fly Free or Die near the end. When time gets us there,
right?
but first off, Adam, you've been the GM for most of these. Zach, you're going to be GMing Fly Free or Die. I know your group started with a very interesting origin story. You were all Song of Ice and Fire fans.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? Yes, right. That is correct.
And you got together and started basically, you were critiquing the show based on your reading of the novels. Is that right?
So, pretty much. Like, we decided that, hey, we're going to sit around and talk about our favorite show through the lens of a book reader.
Yeah.
And yeah, it got to the point to where we ended up just being four very angry people sitting around a microphone because like it deviated so much from the books. And then, of course, there's the last couple seasons were a little disappointing, you know.
Well, see, because you're jumping ahead, that's exactly what I want to ask about. Like, okay, so there's a lot of Game of Thrones, but what was your group's? You said there were four of you. Who were the four of you at this time?
So it was myself, Zach, Heath, and then another friend of ours named Dane, who is not on Southern Tomfoolery as far as our actual play. Life takes over, and so unfortunately he didn't get to come with us on that, but yeah, the four of us were really kind of at the core of it. And we're all in the same music scene. Zach and Heath played music as well, and Dane was just kind of there as part of the scene. And one night he came up to me after the show. He's like, I heard that you like Game of Thrones. We got to talk, you know? And I was like, all right, let's go, you know?
What was that music scene? What music do you guys play?
I guess you would call it funk yeah. Jam, yeah. You know?
Right on.
It's kind of our vibe.
I should have prepped and made you sing on the show. Because I would.
Neither of us are singers.
we always got somebody else to do that.
Yeah. Fortunately.
All right, so what was your group take on the in your consensus on the adaptation of Song of Ice and Fire to Game of Thrones? Like,
right, so that that was our whole angle coming in. The reason we started wanting to talk about it is because we all started reading the books.
Yeah.
Before there was ever a show, I remember going to Adam's house. Heath had given me the first book, which was given to him by Dane, and then I passed it along to Adam. I was like, bro, you got to read this. This is so good.
Yeah.
And that was actual a Game of Thrones, the first book in Song of Ice and Fire. So we were a few books deep when they announced the show, I think. Yeah. And so we were all super excited. We used to all gather up at Dane's house every Sunday and watch it. And we had critiques. We had things we wanted.
Yeah. I think the overall consensus is that we were pretty pleased with seasons 1 through 4, with 2 kind of being an outlier where we first were like, something's off here. But they pulled it back together for 3 and 4. And I think season 4 of Game of Thrones is one of the best seasons of television that's been put out. It's really, really good. And most of the changes that they made from the book were not detrimental, but they created problems for the remainder of the series, right? But part of that is somewhat on George Martin, you know, who gave the rights up to a series that he hadn't finished, you know. A lot of it's on the creators, you know, the showrunners. They just went, by the end of it, we actually did not do our podcast for season 8 because we were too grumpy about it. Like, we started getting complaints, like, all you guys are doing is just complaining for an hour about the show. And we're like, well, that's right.
I do a Star Trek podcast occasionally, and we worked through all 12 movies.
Mm.
And that includes the last 3, of course. And for those 3 films, we were doing a lot of complaining, right?
Right.
So I get what you're saying and how it can be sometimes kind of a downer. Like, it's not fun to record the show. It's not fun to listen to because we're just all kind of saying, man, like, this is a goddamn tragedy is what it is.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, that's exactly how it goes too. You know, something you love is just butchered, essentially.
Well, one last thing about Game of Thrones before we move on. I'm fascinated by, did you guys ever game Game of Thrones? Did you ever RPG in the Game of Thrones setting?
We did not.
No, we didn't. We before we started playing, the first tabletop that we started playing was 5e.
Yes, I'm going to get there because I got Lost Mines of Phandalin on my list.
Nice. Okay. But before we started doing that, you know, before we actually got into tabletop role playing, we made our own version of Westeros, like, in our group chat. It was this whole, like, improvising world building, like, just game that we made up kind of on the spot just because we were bored at work, you know, and, like, we ended up creating, like, a whole map that we each had our own regions for. And we're like, all right, we're going to turn this into a game. And then we're like, nobody wants to do that work. Never mind. It just didn't happen. But, you know, like, we had a pretty good drawn out map with all of our different regions and, like, what our region's
houses
themes were.
And every, yeah.
Yeah, like, what we exported really and stuff. You know?
Did you assign the houses from the setting or did you create new ones?
We created new ones. So we just used that kind of like as a template, like, idea, you know? And then, so, like, we're like, all right, well, I'm going to be in the desert area and we're going to export, like, rock and quarry work, you know, and then I'm going
to
be.
I'm going to make you guys an offer and I want you to just think about this. Okay. Like, the Game of Thrones RPG.
Okay.
There's 2 different versions of that game. And the one that was just one book and the rest was a line that came out from Green Ronin. And it was the Song of Ice and Fire RPG. And then about 6 months ago, they put out a setting agnostic version of that rule set. So it's called the Chronicle game system. It was designed by some pretty brilliant people in our field and in our hobby. And it's got rules for all that stuff, like houses. Like, you make houses like characters and they have actions that you play out.
That's awesome.
As well as your characters that all have status, and like your character, the default player group is a noble house. You are a minor house trying to survive the Game of Thrones, basically. So you give me that map.
And I still have it somewhere.
And I'll marry it to the Chronicle game system, and we'll take your setting and make the RPG out of it.
There we go.
I'll run it for you.
Holy crap.
I mean, if you can find those.
I will find them now. I will dig those maps up.
The hand has been extended. Now, whether you choose to take it or not, I leave to you. All right.
Right. Yeah.
That's awesome.
But then your first game was, as you said, 5th edition. D&D. And you started the Lost Mines of Phandalin, which I know well. I've GM'd that thing more than once. Mm-hmm. How did that go? Like, what did you guys think of it as your first RPG?
So I was the GM of it, and we came together. Initially, Dane wanted us to play D&D. He had been, you know, the Adventure Zone was, like, just kind of becoming in our awareness. Critical Role was kind of happening, and we had all watched Harmon Quest. And just got, like, a huge kick out of that. We're like, oh, that looks fun. Like, let's do that. And so we started, like, this thing with 3.5 edition, and that was, like, 2 sessions that kind of fell apart.
Okay.
And then I moved. so like it was like, oh, there's nothing we can do. But then the advent of like virtual tabletops came like right around that time. I was like, all right, we're doing it. I'm grabbing this 5e module. It says it's like a good starter system of D&D. Great little module.
Yeah.
And I think it is great. I think it was a superb starter module that's fun, but also helps you like learn the game and gives you plenty of opportunities to role play and just get your feet wet in all the aspects of the game. But that, you know, at the end of it, that's when I first got my bug of like, oh, I want to tell like my own story on top of stories, and like did this whole like convoluted, twisted ending, you know. But it was a big moment, I think, for all of us as a group where we're like, this can elevate to something beyond just rolling dice. Like this, we had an emotional response to the end of that adventure, and like immediately we're like, all right, let's do more and like let's take it up a notch, you know.
Well, and it strikes me that increasingly, to me, it seems, the hobby of playing the games around a table with your friends is a completely different thing than an entertainment that you create for thousands of people to watch.
It is.
Definitely. Yeah.
It is.
Can you guys both speak about a little bit about the difference in that, like how the game is created and played and run, and like how is the experience different when you're making it for an audience than when you're making it for yourselves?
I think you have to be a lot more aware of just what you're doing and who your audience is and how you're representing yourself. I don't know. It's like, I don't have like a specific example, but I know that I've been thinking a lot. Like I've GM'd a game before, a Curse of Strahd campaign that we ran for a year and a half, 2 years almost. Mm-hmm. Had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah.
But as I'm gearing up to do Fly for Your Die, there's this whole extra level of like anxiety, because it's not just for the boys anymore. You know what I mean? Like we have an audience, we have people who are going to be listening to this, mm-hmm. and have their own expectations that I want to live up to. And so I know that I'm certainly aware of that, like on that level, but I don't have a specific example that I can think of.
But you're thinking of like, you're always kind of aware of all the people that are watching, and you're trying to please them rather than the four or five or six people at your table.
Yeah, and I think that's a tough balance to strike, because at the end of the day, you still want to do it for the people at the table.
Right.
Right. Those are the primary people involved. If they're not having a good time, nobody listening is going to be having a good time.
Correct. Okay.
You know, but you still want to make it interesting for the listeners outside of making it interesting for the players.
Yeah, I think one of the things that it's funny, because as we played, we recorded ourselves our 5e games. Like now we haven't like put that out, you know, like it's got a bunch of copyrighted music on it, but you know, like we were recording ourselves even when it was just a home game. A lot of it was just to have like a record, you know, so we could like remember what happened. 'Cause there would sometimes be weeks that went and we couldn't, you know, but then like, as I was doing it and putting music to it, it's like, oh, this is fun. And just like learning all those editing techniques and like, so I was already working towards thinking about my sessions as an episodic structure, you know, like I especially towards the later part of 5e before we got into Starfinder, our sessions were like built as episodes in my mind, you know, like as far as how I was pacing it and what we were going to get done. And so it wasn't necessarily we're playing 3 hours tonight. It's we're going to play through this portion, you know, how long it takes, whether it's 2 hours, whether it's 3.5, you know, like this is the story that we're telling tonight. So that was part of it. And then like, as we actually got into recording and putting the game out for people, I think one of the biggest things that I became hyper aware of is combat and trying to make that flow as quickly as possible. And, you know, we talk about it even now, over 100 episodes in, we'll have occasional like, all right, guys, let's remember, let's move through our turns quickly. You know, like, yeah, you might make a mistake, but like, it's also for the sake of people listening. It's okay if you make a mistake, because that's drama, you know, and you're like, you just got to kind of be in it and not hem and haw around it. Now, we still do that, and thankfully we have editing, but you know, like,
you know. Sure. It's interesting. So combat is a challenge and it can drag, is what I'm
Well, from a listening perspective, I think. Like, I think it's fun to play. It's like when you're getting in, that's where you're getting into all the mechanics and all the cool things that your character can do. But for it to be like, you want it to be more than just an hour of rattling off numbers, you know?
So if I was writing an adventure to be streamed, should I have less combat in it and more other stuff?
I don't know.
It's tough. That's tough to say because, like, I personally really enjoy combat. It's one of my favorite things to do. I love trying out my stuff.
Especially in Starfinder, because so much of your character is about how you fight.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You just got tons of class abilities and tons of feats, and they're all about how I fight. So you want to use that shit. You want to pull those levers.
Right, definitely. And, like, people that are listening do want to hear the PC's abilities happen, you know. They want to see all the spells go off, and they want to see all the flash and everything like that. So you can't, I don't think you can excise that completely. I would say an answer to that question, that it's not about having less combats, it's about splitting up combats. So it's not, if you were making an AP specifically to be for a podcast or to be broadcast, you'd want to avoid some of the typical things that happened in APs that are just a series of combat encounters, like in a dungeon, you know. So you would want there to be some other kind of encounter that breaks that up, so you don't have four episodes in a row of combat, you know. Not that you can't make that entertaining. I think, you know, I've certainly heard other podcasts do it. I think we've done it to some success, but, like, if that was your specific mindset, like, all right, how do we make this the best paced for a podcast? It's just split those up a little bit.
Well, so the reason why I asked is because, of course, is exactly what Paizo was doing.
Right.
We've got a whole line now that we've announced called One Shots.
Mm-hmm.
The first two of them are already out. One's for Starfinder, Band on the Run. It came out at PaizoCon this weekend.
Yes. To great acclaim, too.
Because when we debuted it, we had a group already ready to live play it. But so I'm developing the next one, which we haven't announced. And we've got two more coming up that we've got Thurston Hillman, who's a longtime developer on the Starfinder team, developing whose experience is making organized play scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
But those are in many ways designed to be streamed, right? Not only to be streamed, they're good for anybody. But we want to make them streamer friendly.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's why that's interesting. And so don't make it just combat after combat after combat. Break it up, make some different kinds of challenges and some role play opportunities, some exploring opportunities, some opportunities to talk to each other and also to NPCs. Definitely. Maybe sneaking around. There's all kinds of action that's not fighting.
Right.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then one shot too, like, I don't, for me, there's like a certain level of expectation of getting to play around with something like very specific to that one shot that I wouldn't get to do anywhere else, you know? So, like, that's what's appealing to, like, Band on the Run, or I played a organized play scenario on our online convention ourselves that was Star Sugar Heart Love.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You know, I love both of those, obviously, because I'm a musician and they're centered around, you know, performances, music. Yeah. But, like, one of the things that stood out to me about that is that they did have that very strong theme that still allowed me to be the full Starfinder character I was. I mean, I was a Hordus Mystic slinging my mushroom cap around like a force disc, you know, like, I got to do that, which was fun. And I wanted to do that. Yeah. But I also got to, like, perform on stage playing bass dressed up like one of the band, you know what I mean? Like, that was, it just made for a lot of exciting and unique experiences, you know? So
interesting. Okay, so now you've got the Apollo Protection Agents, and this is your main show, right?
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so and you started off doing Against the Aeon Throne.
Mm-hmm.
This is our most played adventure path.
Really?
I mean, that's good. You know, I would have thought it was Dead Sons, but I bet you that fell off pretty quick.
Dead Sons is so popular that the first volume is sold out. It's out of print.
Right.
But it's the three book structure of Aeon well, Throne.
That's part of, see, it's because the first volume of Dead Sons is out of print that people are playing against the Aeon Throne. Right.
Because it's the next option. Yeah.
But yeah, there's three things about Against the Aeon Throne that make it different, that make it unique. First, mm-hmm. it starts at first level.
Mm-hmm.
It's only three volumes long.
Right.
And it's in print.
Right? Oh, well, yeah.
that helps.
The Venn diagram of those three things combined puts Aeon Throne in the center. Jason Keeley, my colleague on the Starfinder team, developed all three of those adventures. And I was an editor when they were coming out. One of my very first jobs when I started as an editor at Paizo was editing The Prison Moon. Prison Moon.
Also a book Eleanor wrote, I believe.
Yeah. And I love that whole prison break sequence. It's just in the outpost bed. Like that adventure's got so much great stuff in it. And I want to, like, if I had my choice, I would put like a drift highway that leads straight to Outpost Zed, right? Like I want.
It's such a great place.
It is. Like, you could run a whole campaign just out of like living on Outpost Zed and going out from there and doing stuff, you know, and like, and it has that kind of DS9, you know, feel to it a little bit. And anyway, so I love that whole adventure path. And then you went to Signal of Screams later, which Chris Sims developed. But let's talk about Aeon Throne first. What, Adam, you were the GM on this. Zach, you were playing. Is that right?
Yes. Correct. Yeah.
So what was your experience with this? Like, how did it go?
I mean, we loved it.
Yeah.
You know, like, we have very high praise for Aeon Throne. You know, I think it's, from my perspective, it would be the one that I would suggest any Starfinder, new Starfinder to play. You know, like, it's just great. It's just, what I liked about it for us is, you know, we put Southern in our name, right? So there's potentially certain connotations that get associated with that, that we're trying to elevate beyond, because there's a lot of like great culture here in the South, you know, despite all the kind of things around it, you know? So we're like, well, let's just go ahead and fight space Nazis and just like, we're going to plaster that right there. That's what we're doing, you know? Yeah. So to that point, it's a very, very distinctive enemy right from the start. You know, like, you know, the villains, like, and you can immediately be like, all right, I'm against these dudes. And like, so it's just a good way for them to kind of, I thought, for the players, I'll let Zach speak to it, but to draw them into the world of Starfinder, into the setting, because they didn't have to think too hard about what their objective was. It was, I get to just soak in all the cool stuff that's around, you know?
Yeah, you know, if there's a Nazi, you punch him in the face.
Right.
Yeah. And also, you know, what makes him a great villain is it's also easy for you to like get it. There's a lot of parallels to like the Star Wars Empire, for example, that there's just, it's easy to pick up on what this is, what's going on. You understand it. What I really like about the AP is the way that book one starts off with a pretty small sandbox with Nacondas. And it's you can't abandon the plot and go start a bar. Like, it's not that you're railroaded because you have lots of options, but you're here on this thing. You're doing the thing. Yeah. You can't just give up on the plot. So you have like a limited sandbox. It's very easy for you to learn the system of Starfinder while on this adventure. And then as you get into book two, when you go to Outpost Zed, you get some of the really weird alien aspects of Starfinder. And it kind of like, it starts with a narrow focus that broadens as it goes. And then it kind of comes back full circle as you go to Aurelos and get all of that. And it ties up so nicely. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, it expands out, introduces you to the world, and then it also resolves that plot in a really easy to follow along with arc and at a decent pace as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to tell you a little bit about some of the behind the scenes on Against the Aeon Throne. Rob McCreary, our creative director at the time, he was he wanted the Aslani Empire, Star Empire, the Aslani Star Empire. We always have to clarify because the Aslani thousands of years ago. But the Aslani Star Empire, he wanted them to be sort of this big looming threat, you know, and they show up with like one starship in the middle of Dead Suns for no reason really, except to show the players, hey, we exist, right?
Right, mm-hmm. right.
Star Empire out there. And then we always sort of thought that the second AP would be the Aslanti AP. But then we decided to make it only three books long. And this posed special challenges because Aslanti Star Empire stormtroopers are the Aeon Guards, right? Mm-hmm. Right there, like the one of the first creatures in the Alien Archive 1, right? And they've got
right.
like really distinctive green armor with the awesome faceplate.
Yeah, Aeon awesome armor. Armor.
Yeah. Boom. Yeah.
And they're like CR3. Right, like,
yeah,
and your first level characters, you can't fight one stormtrooper, let alone no. a squad of them, right? Like,
right.
We made the Aslanti enemy, the basic Aslanti mook, is too powerful for us to use in large numbers in the Aslanti AP.
Right,
we had to,
right.
You know this, Adam, because yeah. you had to deal with all of these like. Aeon Guard trainees,
yeah, yeah,
Aeon Guard rookies, and all this stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
We just announced not that long ago the second self-contained adventure for Starfinder, the Liberation of Locus One.
Yeah,
we're calling this the Module Line, and it's a 64-page standalone adventure. Starts at fourth level, goes to seventh. And the Aslanti Star Empire are key bad guys, right? There's nice. Pirates in the system, like you. There's a it's a sort of classic keep on the borderlands setup. And you guys are fairly new to D&D, so you may not even know what I'm talking about.
I don't actually.
All right, well, so we're gonna go back in the way back clock on the way back machine here.
Okay,
yeah, here we go.
Yeah,
basic Dungeons and Dragons, basic D&D. You had the white box, which is just Dungeons and Dragons. With like these three sort of parchment colored books that were in it, right? Greyhawk, Eldritch, Wizardry, and Blackmoor. That was the original sort of D&D set. But then they came out with this box that was called Basic Dungeons and Dragons, and it had an adventure in it. And that adventure was called Into the Unknown, I think. And they had a sequel called Keep on the Borderlands. And this is where we get this idea of the Caves of Chaos. And the idea is that you create this castle on the outskirts of civilization. Okay. And there's this adventure site around it with basically a bunch of caves. And there's different creatures living in every cave. So you've got like the Kobold Cave and the Orc Cave and the Gnoll Cave, right? And
right.
the Bear Cave. And, you know, it's pretty basic adventure setup.
It's Ravenloft.
But the beauty of it is that there's just all these holes, all these caves in this huge pit in the ground, and the players can investigate any cave that they want to in whatever order they want to explore them in, right? So it's like that sort of mini sandbox like you were describing, right? Mm. Like 12 different caves. And then they can retreat back to the keep, the famous keep on the Borderlands, where there's NPCs that are there, and some of them will help you, and some of them are traitors, and, you know, it's kind of it's your home base. So yeah. The idea is the players, they go to this play, they go to this castle, and then they explore out from it, exploring the caves, and they retreat back to the keep to rest and recover, and then they go back out again. And this adventure is like 40 years old, right? Like, it's one of the original adventures for D&D. And for many people who bought the basic set, it was the first adventure for D&D. It's kind of set the stage. All right. History lesson. But anyway.
Thank you.
So the Liberation of Locus One is kind of inspired by that keep on the Borderlands. You have like this scientific magic research station in this remote star system, right? And it's investigating this bizarre cosmological phenomenon called the Locus, which is like a star, but magic. It's like we call it a metastar. And And there's planets that are around it, and the planets all have life, but magic acts chaotic and weird whenever you're near the Locus, and we don't really know what it is. And you arrive at this station, and so then, like, there's shit going on. There's pirates in the system that are raiding, you know, and attacking the researchers. And then to defend themselves against the pirates, the Science Council, which is the rulers of Locust One, they go to the nearest government and say, will you help us against these pirates? Well, the nearest government is the Atlantean Star Empire.
Oops.
Oh, God.
So the cure ends up being worse than the disease, right?
Yeah.
But
you've got multiple threats. But then also you've got all the worlds of the Locust system, which all have mysteries and plots on them. So you kind of arrive on the station, you have an inciting event, and then you have this big sandbox where there's like these four little mini missions, and you can take them in whatever order you want. And then there's a big climactic sort of Star Wars style climax space battle when the Atlantis Star Empire shows up to take control of the station, right?
And yeah.
So you got to defend the command post on the station while also doing starship combat against the Atlantis Star Destroyer, right? So, yeah.
Ooh, that sounds like a lot of fun.
The reason why I bring all that up is because we're trying to learn from the challenges of the Against the Aeon Throne adventure, right? So we wanted – that's why we made Locust One levels 4 to 7, mm-hmm. that you could be 7th level and fight a squadron of 4 Aeon guards.
Right.
Yeah.
Like as they're supposed to be
rather than fighting.
Yeah. Because anyway, I mean, it's a lot of one-on-ones throughout Aeon Throne, right? Like, but I think that I will say that one of the things that I think we all thought when we first picked up Aeon Throne is that we were going to be going against the Aslanti. And, you know, slight spoilers here, it's not really that, you know, it ends up becoming a much more focused kind of espionage.
Yeah.
Thing that's like happens on the like circumference or the periphery of the Aslanti Empire, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which turned out to make for a really cool story, like, you know, that's believable because even at level 7, or 6 or whatever, where it's like you end it, I'm like, 3 books, like, how are they going against the whole empire? They're asking me, like, we're gonna only be like level 6 when this is over. Like, wow, you know, it's like, well, just be patient. You'll see.
Well, ultimately, what both of these adventures are telling us is we need to do a high level Atlantis Star Empire story,
mm-hmm.
right? Where if you're gonna fight the Star Empire and you're gonna be like Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, you're gonna go in at a decent level, 8 or higher.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, at least.
And you're gonna like really shake the galaxy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, something I think one of those higher levels, kind of like Devastation Arc.
Yeah,
honestly.
Yeah,
a 3 book something. You know, it would be awesome.
I'm gonna need to go ahead and release that now, so we can we can tie that into our current APA arc.
Well, you know, Devastation Arc was sort of pitched as a sequel to Dead Sons.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a tight sequel. Like, anybody can play it, but it has thematic connections to Dead Sons.
Yeah.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I totally agree with you. It would be great to do that. We've talked in the Star Chamber about shaking up the setting a little bit. There's maybe not enough conflict in it. Like, the Vescarium, the Atlantean Star Empire, the Pact Worlds are all at peace with one another, or at least not fighting.
Yeah, at least at a ceasefire or something, yeah.
Yeah, and the Swarm has been repelled, right? Mm-hmm. Like, not, and maybe that shouldn't be true. Maybe we need to have, like, some kind of big conflict going on somewhere.
Yeah.
That the players can just jump into whenever they want. And we haven't made any decisions yet, but it's something that we talked about.
Yeah, and I know that's got to be a struggle with, like, how much agency you want to allow the players to have to affect the setting at large.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know how the canon works to where, like, the events of this are canon or not. So I couldn't speak. But I know that as a player personally, I really enjoy being able to see some kind of results of what we've done.
Yeah.
Play out, even if it's just within the AP, you know, at the end, not necessarily like with the setting at large, but something like where you can.
You'll see that in Fly for Your Die.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
The characters are specifically there to be influenced by the PC's actions, right? Like that's why they're in the book.
Right. Yeah, I know. And I love that. I, when I, when I finally got to reading book five, and I was like, is the payoff. This is the payoff for everything. Yes, 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 yes. Please give me more. Yeah.
All right. Well, whenever the shipping crate gets unlost.
All right. So you guys did it against the Aeon Throne up to about level six or so. Mm-hmm. And then you made that shift over to Signal of Screams. Now, we assumed a lot of players would do that. And I think there's a little sidebar, like how to integrate the two adventure paths and move over from one to the next. But how did that work for you? Like, it's a big change in tone. You went from Star Wars to Hellraiser. Right.
Yeah, that was definitely heavy on my mind as we were approaching the end of Aeon Throne and like so starting to get ready for Signal of Screams, because it's the same characters, right? So yeah. I've got to connect those characters through there. So we actually did do like kind of an extended interlude after the final events of Aeon Throne. We did kind of like an epilogue for that and then an interlude in between that. Okay, well, there's some 6 months that passed and we kind of just reviewed what happened to the characters during that 6 months. And like within those, I started planting some of the stuff that you run into early with Signal Scream. So not so much a lot of the horror stuff, but like they went to a Buzzblades game during the interlude. Yes. You know what I mean? So like now, when they got there, the Buzzblades were somebody that they like knew and were interested in connecting with, you know. And I was fortunate that I have one character that is like, well, I've said I have one player that is full on like, give me the corruption mechanics. I'm ready to do it, you know. And so she's helped kind of bring it as a focal point that I could kind of used to bring the whole party along, you know. So it, and I think Signal Screams does a pretty good job of, it doesn't really matter what you were doing before it, like what happens at that resort takes over whatever else is going on in your life, you know. Like what
that was Emily, right?
I will also say, to Adam's credit, he started planting the seeds of Signal of Screams all the way back in Aeon Throne. There's backstory stuff tied up there that he managed to integrate. I guess you read Signal before we ever even started.
Mm-hmm. I read all of Aeon Throne and all of Signal of Screams before we recorded episode one, just because I knew I wanted to do those two together. And then Devastation Arc came out and I was like, all right, well, there's season three or whatever ready to go. But yeah, like there was a lot of things that I wanted to do thematically that I think I was able to, Aeon Throne made some space for it, knowing where we were going, you know, that towards the end of Aeon Throne, things started getting a little weird. You know, I started leaning into the kind of multidimensional stuff to kind of grease the wheels for the eventual interplanar crap that happens to the players. So I don't know. I think they pair well together. It is a significant shift, and we had several conversations as a player group about, okay, you know, we are going into horror, kind of like, let's just check our boundaries. And we're all very comfortable with each other, and I think we all are on the same mindset of like what our lines are, and they're all very similar. But it was good to just check in and make sure before we got into it, you know? And then we like made a kind of a notice to our listeners too, that, hey, we are about to be a different vibe. We're going to still be funny and do the things that we're still us, but the tone of the game is going to be very different. And so far, I don't think it's been so much that's caused whiplash to anybody big time, you know.
There's been small amounts of whiplash
there's been
that
a little
we've
bit,
gotten from listeners, but mostly everybody's on board. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that's to be expected. I mean, whenever you go from any big project to the next big project, some people are gonna miss the first one, you know, like
Different album, you know.
Yeah, right.
Second album.
Okay, it's Westworld's third season. I'm like, okay, look, I came here for the Be in the Park, right? Like, if I If we're not in Westworld, I'm not interested. And so
right. Yeah.
It's the name of the show. Why are we there?
Yeah. So how have you reached Devastation Arc yet?
No. We're about halfway through Signal of Screams right now. I've added a lot more to this one.
Yeah.
I mean, I added, you know, a handful to Aeon Throne, but we have a whole like separate party going on in this one. So there's just like, it's a much more expanded story, taking us a little bit longer to get through it because of that. But like for me, you know, this is our Empire Strikes Back, right? So like, this is the meat of the character development. So like using horror as a means to like really dig into who these characters are and like get all the way down to their roots and break them all the way down before they get to go be the Avengers and Devastation Arc. Like that's my goal, is to spend this breaking them all the way down so that when they become superheroes, they feel it, you know?
Yeah. It feels earned.
That's really right. Interesting to think of it as like the Empire Strikes Back of your campaign. And just to note that, because often the middle book is perceived as where things, I'm not talking about the Empire Strikes Back, but in general, like in a trilogy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The middle book is the one that drags, right? Because it's not the beginning and it's not the climax. It's just like all the filler shit in the middle.
Right.
But you're describing it very differently. Like, no. This is the time where I get a chance to figure out what really makes these characters tick.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We get to probe that character development and really kind of get to the heart of these characters. That's interesting that you took that opportunity in Signal of Screams. I like it.
Yeah. I mean, the subject matter provides it, you know. Yeah. It's like what happens with these characters who if everything gets stripped away from them, what's left? You know, if their powers get stripped away from them, or their ship gets stripped away from them, or their sanity gets stripped away from them, you know, or not necessarily their sanity, but their like grip on what they think is real.
Real.
You know, what is that? What's left? And then what do we rebuild from there? You know, doing that hero's journey type of thing where you have that moment where everything is lost, you know, that moment where Frodo just like, I can't do this anymore. You know, like,
do it.
Like, like pushing to get to that point to as Zach said, to make the then very bombastic Devastation Arc like feel earned and exciting and be like a relief almost to this season of grimdark, world's premier grimdark podcast. Yeah. That was part of the whiplash. It's like,
yeah,
I mean, we like them, but I mean, they've just kind of grimdark lately. It's so funny because you're so goofy. Like, we say the dumbest stuff on the show. You know, like,
well, that there's a great tradition of that in grimdark games, though. Also, right?
Right.
My friend Thurston, he runs Warhands. I don't know if you guys watch that show. And that's what's a Warhammer 40K livestream,
right?
You know, and they are goofy as fuck, right? Like, they're just, but the setting is also just bizarre, like, you know, it's
right.
So
yeah,
there's something about like you can take that horror and you can also be kind of goofy and make fun of it. And yourself.
Well, you got to have some comic relief because you don't like, as much as I'm talking about bringing the characters down, I don't want it to be a bummer to listen to.
That's
you
right.
know what I mean? So like, it's even more important for us as players to have energy and be having a good time and laughing with each other because the characters are suffering, you know, and I don't want to, I don't want to do like 12 hours straight of just, oh my God, this is just so heavy, you know, like every, you know, it's an hour of listening to these people be miserable. Like, that's not, you know.
Now, I want to get to a couple of logistics questions for a minute. Okay, so your individual episodes are only like an hour, right?
An hour, hour and a half, yeah.
And you record approximately every
week.
Week.
Every week. Okay, so you have a week to prep an hour and a half long session.
No,
we record two sessions.
Okay.
Or to just get a little runway, because obviously we miss weeks from time to time. So, we try to record two episodes in one session.
Okay, so you prep for a week, you record 3 hours, and that gives you a backlog, and you don't have to record every week.
Right. If somebody goes on vacation and gets sick, we're good, you know.
Yeah, you've got a season in the can. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I wouldn't say a season. That'd be nice, but that'd be nice, but no.
That's some episodes in the can.
Yeah.
All right. So you guys have been doing a fundraiser on Patreon. for some time to gather funds for another show to do Fly Free or Die.
Yes. Correct.
How long have you been planning that?
Since it was announced, really.
Yeah, honestly. Last year at PaizoCon, you know?
We
started making plans.
We had been talking about wanting to do another show. Zach is expressing some interest in GMing, you know? And we actually considered doing the Threefold Conspiracy first. Yep. And I think that was before Fly Free or Die was announced. Yep. And Zach read a couple of those, and it just didn't click with him. It wasn't the type of game that
I didn't think it would make a good show for our table.
Well, it's very X-Files.
Yeah.
And X-Files was 20 years ago.
Well, for instance, John would have loved it. John would have been 100% for it. Okay. But, you know, the investigation.
Yep. We're just kind not very of good aspect at that.
Of, yeah.
We're just not very good at that.
Well, that's important, right? Yeah. Play to your strengths, right? Yeah.
But, you know, then Fly Free or Die came out, or, you know, the announcement of it and the theme to it, you know, like, okay, we're Southern Tomfoolery. Here's a blue collar space truckers against corporation or whatever kind of vibe. And it just was like, that's it. That's what we're going
to
do.
Yeah, that one spoke to me. I think it was like immediate. I was like, yes, this is the one. This is the one we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, before the show started, Zach, you and I were talking about the character of Tarika, right? And because I can do her accent, you know.
I already got it. Like I read two lines in her very first blurb, and I was like, I got this.
She says y'all. I mean,
she says y'all. Yeah. Howdy y'all. Yeah. I can't wait. I immediately fell in love with the character. She's this absolutely adorable Brunieri with a big old rusty wrench is her favorite item, and just a sweet, wholesome mom energy. You know,
the funny thing, so a little backstory to Tarika, of course, she was originally going to be a Morlamon.
Oh, really? That's the walrus, right?
The walrus people.
Yeah.
and Morlamons are kind of like persona non grata sometimes in the Starfleet Chamber because they're considered a little bit too goofy. Right? Rob McCreary was like anti-Morlamaw. So he said, well, you get one Morlamaw. And I'm like, he has a daughter who's in episode 3.
Yeah.
So now two. And
I'm going to
get two. Well, but when BJ Hensley, who wrote the first volume, started to work on the adventure, she was not into the Morlamaw. She was like, it's not working with the character that I see her as. Does it have to be a Morlamon? I'm like, no, right? She doesn't. There's nothing in her. She has to be aquatic.
Yes.
She has to be able to go underwater because daughter is in the third adventure, which is on the water planet.
Yes.
But they don't have to be like Kalo. They don't have to be fish people. They just have to be able to go in the water. Mm-hmm. They have to have a swim speed, basically.
Yeah, right.
And she's like, okay, well, so BJ got on Discord with Joe Pacini, Starfinder lead designer, who was writing Volume 3, Professional Courtesy, and that's where Shan is a major character.
Right.
And they threw around ideas, and they settled on Brunieri, and they came back to me and said, can I make her an otter person? And I'm like, sure, go for it, right? So that's just I guess the only moral here is listen to your writers, right? Like, if they want to... Often the compensation for writing for a role-playing game is often not very great. I mean, we pay you a rate, and it on a big project, it can be a fairly sizable paycheck. But to me, one of the rewards of writing RPGs, of making RPGs, is the creative fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
Getting able to see the thing that you want become real and hear other people play it. There's an artistic goal, artistic expression.
Yeah.
And I want to give the writers or you guys, you know, you want to let the creators make their own changes to it. So anyway, this is a long way of beginning around to saying, Zach, you have my permission to change anything in this adventure.
Oh, great. Awesome.
Cool. I am not going to get offended. I am not. All I'm going to do is ask you to come back on the show and tell me why you changed it. And what you think of the change and how it works.
Oh, definitely.
So we're gonna change the name of this show to Oops all Mormolals.
Great. Well, that's okay. That's all right, fair enough. All right. Rob can shake his fist from the grip.
Yeah. No, but I'm really, really excited to run it. There are a lot of really, really cool moments in this AP. Sure. As we're talking about Tarika and Shan and book three, I don't want to like specify something because I don't want Adam to know. But like, but let's say it's the penultimate moment of book three.
Yeah.
I was reading it and I was like, "This is awesome! This is so cool!"
After he finished book three, he blew up our chat. Like,
no kidding,
y'all. This is gonna be what's up.
I'm gonna tell you that's very gratifying because I have gotten some critiques about book three.
Really?
Yeah, because it's very different than the rest of the AP, right?
Absolutely, like, absolutely.
You're not flying around doing jobs. It's not like the volume. Volume one and volume two are like, you know, we do the job, we get paid. And it's got a lot of kind of episodic quality to it. And you're flying all over the Pact Worlds or the Vescarium in volume two. But I felt like we had to kind of change it up a little bit. And I also wanted book three to be, will you do what, I wanted to be an ethical questions.
Yeah.
Will you do what is right when there's no money in it, right? Which is why it's called professional courtesy, because Tarika comes to you and says, like, look, I need a favor.
Right.
I can't pay you. I don't have anything. Like, will you do this? Well, Tarika's done stuff for you, man. Like,
yeah, she's helped you so much by that point that it would be really terrible of you to turn her down.
I'm turning it down. I'm going to go ahead and tell you now. Spoiler, I'm turning it down.
Turn her down.
It works best if there's actually one person in the team who's like, no, we don't do shit for free. We work for money, right? And then everybody else, if this is Serenity, you got to have the Jane character, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got to have the Jane who's like, hey, you know, like, time is money and I don't work for free. And that's perfectly in theme with this AP. Like, that's a valid stance to have in this story.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm glad that you like it because
yes, it's so alien. It's so mystical.
Yeah.
I was like beaming after I was like, I cannot wait to see what my players are going to think of this, you know, and how it plays out because it's just so different than what you're expecting.
That's right.
You know?
Well, you know, a lot of APs have like one volume that's very different than the rest of the AP. That's kind of the palate cleanser adventure, you know, where you do something very different and then you come back and do the finale, which is more of what you would kind of expect. Mm-hmm. And normally that palate cleanser is volume four, sometimes five. To use the music analogy, it's the bridge.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
It's that moment in the song where you like go off and do an instrumental for 30 seconds and then you come back, you know, to do the final chorus. Well, in Fly, Fear, Die, the bridge is early. It's volume three.
Nice.
Well, I think volume five, obviously I haven't read six yet, but five is kind of like that. You know, it resets your expectations and the gameplay of it is a lot different than what you're expecting. I think one and two are really good. Two especially is like just a great space Western.
Yeah, well,
you know, I mean, it's just such an awesome space Western. I mean, you're really
Leo Glass, who wrote it, would be very gratified to hear you say that because Leo grew up in the Midwest. He's from Ohio, I think, and he grew up on a farm.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So when we've got this scene where you're herding Def Rexes for credits, right? And he's like, okay, I know how to herd animals. So he could write this whole like mini game sequence.
Nice. Yeah, there's a lot. Nice. There's mechanics involved.
Yeah. For how to herd wild Def Rexes. And I'm like, God, I can't. I'm so glad I hired Leo to write that adventure because I wouldn't have had any idea how to do it. Right.
Right. Yeah, it was very well fleshed out, and I was like, okay, like this is, I can work with this. You know, this is so. Really cool moments. So far, three is definitely my personal favorite. Yeah.
Kieran, the editor, my main editor, the whole editorial team, which is like eight people, I think. Everybody takes turns on these books, so I have no idea who all looked at it. But they have an editorial contact, kind of an editing lead, on every given project. And that's kind of the liaison between the editorial team and all of the other teams. So in this case, that was Kieran. And Kieran described Volume 3 as the water level, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is. It's the water temple of
Fluffy Die. And Joe laughed and he said, it's totally the water level. But yeah. But I grew up on like Jacques Cousteau, right? And I'm an unabashed Aquaman fan. And I wanted to add, like you were saying, I wanted to create this kind of mystical. I wanted the change, the player characters who are these kind of working class, you know, paycheck, living day to day, like just kind of the mundanity of modern life, except in space. Mm-hmm. Well, let's put them in something very, very different than what they expect. And there's this kind of sense of wonder to science fiction where you encounter something brand new that just kind of blows your mind. And you're like, wow, like that's amazing.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to put that in this and the water, the aquatic environment gave me a chance to do that.
Yeah, because it's something that most people are not living underwater. They're not experiencing this. And especially, you know, with the specific circumstances that are going on this planet.
Yeah.
This is not something that most people in the packed worlds are going to encounter.
Make sure you watch The Abyss before you run that adventure.
It's okay. One of my favorite movies of all time.
Well, The Abyss is a huge influence on that. And I made Joe watch it. Before you write this adventure, you need to watch this movie. And he's like,
I mean, water in of itself kind of has its an inherent mystical quality, right? Like of all the elements, it seems the most kind of fluid, for lack of a better word, but you know, it has a magic to it that you can almost sense but not understand, you know.
Well, it's very interesting the way that you think about it. I think you're right. I think that the water itself as an object, as a thing, has informed the words that we use to describe it, right?
Yeah.
And so you can see the surface, but you can't see what lies beneath, right? Like, right. The basic structure is part of the poetry of the English language now. And we don't even know that we're using it half the
time. Right.
Anyway, it's wild
stuff. Yeah, but yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm super, super excited. I've really enjoyed going through and
your patrons are successful. You raised the money that you needed.
Yes. Thanks to you in no small part as well. So
one of many. and so when does it start? When can we look forward to listening to it? Are you playing it already?
We have we've started some, I guess you would say, pre-production stuff. Okay. We have. I'll go ahead and tell Adam. Yeah. Asked, is it okay for us to talk about this? So we're starting with what are going to be the interview logs for each character's interview with EdgeCorp.
Nice. Okay.
And we're going to release one of those a week.
Okay.
To kind of give you just a little flavor of each of the characters.
So that's a way to introduce all the characters. Is there?
Right.
Yes.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
So they're like little teaser episodes that come out before the first episode proper. And so you don't like really get to know the characters because they're putting on their like interview face, you know what I mean? So, but it's pretty cool.
Gotcha.
What's going to be interesting is how you see each of these characters navigate the corporate bullshit of this interview space versus how they actually act.
Yeah. Right.
Prying eyes aren't watching.
Like The Office, right? Where they act one way and then they have like a private, like, and that was all bullshit. Like,
Right, exactly.
And the ones we've already done, I've cracked up because I sent them, I basically told them, I said, here are a list of interview questions of the most common bullshit corporate interview
questions. Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Exactly. Yes. And that's one of them. And I sent them a list. I said, I want you to fill them out. Send me your answers. I'm going to pick, you know, 5, 6, 7 of them. Yeah. And then we're going to cut just a quick 5-minute recording interview. Mm-hmm. And, we've got a few of those in the can already.
Yeah, I actually finished editing two of them today. So that's
great. Okay.
And then, we're going to have an actual teaser, I guess, video.
Oh yeah.
Trailer. Yeah. Like a short little
trailer.
Little YouTube trailer.
And then I think we'll actually start releasing episodes towards the end of July.
Yeah. So to give you some hard dates, we're going to start with the character interviews on June 9th. And as Zach said, that'll go one a week, every, you know, weekly from there. And then the trailer drops on July 14th and episodes 1 through 3. All three of those will drop on July 20th. So we're going to start with a 3 big drop. And then it's going to be a bi-weekly show at first.
Okay.
We may go to weekly, but with all the other shows that we have in production, we want to make sure that we can do that kind of recording schedule before we commit to that. So we're doing bi-weekly to start, but we are dropping that big chunk of, you know, 3 episodes right out the bat. So
get us hooked.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
That's good. All right. Well, I would really love to have you guys come back on. Not soon, because you got to play through the adventure first. But when you get to the end of the first volume, I would love to have you back on.
Post-mortem.
Definitely. Yeah.
Talk about like what you changed and what the players thought and what worked and what didn't.
We'd love to do that.
Yeah, and absolutely.
I want to encourage everybody, like, you know, there should be a link to the Sometime Foolery Patreon in our show notes here. So please follow them. And thank you so much, both of you, for coming on and talking
Thanks
about
Thanks for having us, man.
It's always a pleasure talking
always,
with you.
Always, yeah, always, yeah.
All right, well, I'm going to let these two guys go because it's 3 hours later for them. So, and I'm going to go get some chicken. So you guys... Thanks to everyone. And I'll be back with the fifth volume of Fly Fear Die that we were just talking about, Crash and Burn, very soon. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Excellent. Bye.
Thanks, Jason.